So I wanted to know, well, what are the stats for the dice stores, right? So I can compare, you know, benchmark myself or have a goal. And again, no benchmark numbers, no stats, no numbers. Nobody knows what's the size of the dive industry. Nobody even knows that.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast with host Nick Hogel. Scuba diving is a sport, but also at the end of the day, a business. In this episode, I sit down with Business of Diving Institute founder and author, Darcy Kieran. I speak with him about his early days in the industry, the positives and negatives of owning a dive shop, the lack of data throughout the industry, advice for people getting into the business, why he founded the Institute, and much more. Please enjoy. Darcy, how are you doing this morning for you over there on the East Coast?
I'm doing great, except I'm talking to you instead of being underwater.
Well, hopefully there's time for that a little bit later today for you. Are you headed out for a dive or?
Not today, but soon, I hope.
Okay. Me too. I'm long overdue to get under the water. I was actually just at a Malaysia scuba diving expo, dive resort and travel. They have it all over Asia, but they had a show this past weekend in Kuala Lumpur. So I was able to go there and network, meet some people, spend some money that I probably shouldn't have spent, but it's usually how it goes, right?
Did you dive?
I did not. I talked to a lot of divers, though. Future guests of the podcast.
Yeah. I always wonder why the DEMA show wasn't at a place where we could. The DEMA show is in North America, dive industry. I always wonder why it's not at a place where we can go diving. But then I'm thinking, if it was at a place where we can go diving, maybe there would be nobody in the convention center.
Yeah. That's true.
So that it's in Las Vegas and places like that.
Well, yeah, I'll just jump right in. So my first question I always like to ask is, tell me about how and why you got into scuba diving. Tell me about that first breath underwater. Was it an amazing moment? Was it, I hate this, yeah, I'm never doing this again? Tell me all about it.
I loved it, and it's when I started taking courses that I hated it. But I don't know. It's a long story, and I'm not supposed to say it because I first went scuba diving without any training whatsoever, and alone. So that's how I started, and it was in Tonga, near Fiji. You know, for people who don't know where it is, I was sailing with my brother. We had a sailboat, and we took like a year sailing around the world, and well, actually not around the world, but all over the Pacific Ocean. And my brother had bought diving gear if he needed to go check something under the boat, right? And he also didn't have any training whatsoever, but I mean, he would only use it to go check the keel or anything else. And so I wanted to try it. We were anchored in front of an island. There's nobody there. So I put it on. He told me, you know, this time you do it, deflate the BCD, inflate, and breathe. And that's it. I went all by myself, and I saw black coral, the first dive of my life. And I loved it. I mean, it was amazing. But, I mean, it's the Pacific Ocean is so much nicer, you know, compared to so much more to see. And we were totally off the beaten track. I mean, nobody diving there. So the coral was amazing. The sea life was amazing. There was nothing not to be impressed by it. I mean, so that's how I started. And I loved it. And then later on, I was, you know, back to working to make some money. And I was working for a railroad, in the railroad industry, and I was bored. I was totally bored. I remember sitting at my desk thinking, should I resign because this job is boring, or what could I do? And I was very well paid for not doing much. So I figured, well, what what could I do that I've always wanted to do that I didn't have time? And that's when scuba diving came back to my mind. You know, I really liked it. You know, when I was diving alone, I loved it. So I said, why not I take a course? You know, so I registered that day and I did my open water course in the pool. And then I went to Key West to get certified because it was up north and it was in the fall and I wanted to go get certified right now. And they told me, oh, it's too cold. You have to come back. We'll keep you and we'll do it in the spring. And I said, no. So I flew right away and I didn't know where to go. I mean, it's part of the all kind of criticism I have of the dive industry is often the dive instructors don't want to sell because selling is not a good thing they want to do, right? They are above it. But I wanted my instructor to tell me where I should go for a certification, but the guy wouldn't tell me because, you know, he didn't want to sell me a trip. But I just want to know where to go. I mean, I don't know. So I just took the map and I said, well, I'll go the further south. I mean, Key West was further south, so I couldn't go any further than that. And that's why I went there. And then I realized then that that probably was not the best place. Maybe I should have had stopped in Key Largo, but I didn't know. Nobody had told me. So I went to Key West. I got certified. But that's when I hated it. See? So, I don't know. I always question this idea of, you know, you have to take courses to go diving, because when I went diving all by myself without training, I had a great time. And when I went to Key West to get my certification, I actually dropped out. I went back to the dive shop and I told them, I'm not coming back tomorrow. That's it. Forget it. I mean, it was a nightmare the way it was organized and unprofessional the dive instructor was. And I said, forget it. You know, I have other things to do with my life than suffering to this BS. So I had a great time before being certified, and during certification, I almost dropped out.
Okay. And okay.
I was lucky. There was a gal in that dive center who said, well, I'm good. And I didn't even ask for a refund. I'm just letting you know I'm not here tomorrow. And she said, look, I will refund you everything, including today. But first, I would like you to go back and I'll pair you with an instructor I know. And you'll just go diving, no skills, nothing. You're just going to go diving with that guy tomorrow morning. And if you don't like it after that, then I'll refund you everything. Well, okay, why not? I mean, I'd book an hotel room there for a week. So, okay, fine. And that's the reason. So the unfortunate thing is I don't recall who that person was, but that person, the instructor I was with was totally unprofessional, but that person in the dive store made the difference, because otherwise today I would have had dropped out and that would have been the end of it. But that person convinced me to do that. I went and I had a great time. The guy was professional. Found out later he was a course director and he's really good and showed me all kind of stuff and we had fun. And so that's it. So the rest of the week I finished my certification. And so that's how I started.
Oh man, that's a couple things there. First question I wanted to ask about that is, so when you went diving by yourself before you got certified, did you know to clear, like how to clear, like, did you have any issues with that? Cause I know like when I first went diving, I didn't know anything about that. So I was like, okay, what's going on? Was it just, did it come natural? Like, okay, I need to clear, or were you just dealing with the pain? Like, how did that go?
No, my brother told me, I did the pinch the nose exhale. And I remember I had some issues at first at, you know, breaking the surface to go down. Because obviously I was breathing way too much because I was excited. Hey, I'm going to go underwater with that thing. Right. So, and you see that when you teach open water course, you know, people and that's why a lot of instructors put way too much weight on students, because the students are too excited, breathing too much. And instead of getting them to calm down, and they put more weight on the person. So So I had a bit of an issue with that, obviously, because I was breathing a lot. And are you sure I'm going down here? But eventually, I mean, there was no rush. We had nothing to do. We were just hanging. Yeah. So I took my time, eventually calmed down and okay, deflate the BZ, descend. I put more air in and yeah, it worked fine. It worked perfectly fine.
And the other thing I wanted to say is that that's absolutely amazing that because I've seen it go both ways where, you know, you have someone that's ready to quit the class and the instructor or whoever's in charge of it, it's basically like, okay, well, you know, sorry, it didn't work out. I'll see you later. But the fact that right. someone took the time to be like, hey, just give it yeah. another chance. Let's go out and just have some fun. And see and because they, you know, a lot of people after you've been diving for a while, you know that like if you could just kind of get that I don't want to call it hatred, but I understand like going into a course, some people they think it's going to be a lot of fun, it's going to be this good time, and then you start doing skills, people are like I absolutely hate this. But if they can get past that and see the fun side of it, so that's awesome that they took the time to yeah. do that because. Not everybody will. So that is a level of professionalism that I yeah. feel like is lacking sometimes in the industry for sure.
That woman made the difference. That's the reason I kept diving. That's for sure. But then at the same time, maybe they shouldn't have paired me with a totally unprofessional instructor to start with. I mean, but that's a different issue, right? But I mean, that guy was. I mean, it's. I mean, the good thing is I've used a lot of example. Because I eventually became a course director and I trained instructors, and I mean, I've often used examples of what that guy did as what not to do. But, you know, I said, fine. But I mean, that guy shouldn't have been teaching, or somebody should have coached him so that he can become a proper dive instructor. But he wasn't. You know, he had this petty open water scuba instructor card, but I don't know where the heck he bought it. But he certainly was not an instructor.
Yeah, there's definitely just so much to say about that too, especially what you had mentioned that they shouldn't have paired you with him, because I've seen that go, you know, I hate to use the term south, where people just get paired up with the wrong instructor or the wrong individuals get paired up together. And I feel that I've actually seen it where people have quit because they just didn't like the yeah. method of the person teaching. And that's such a bummer too, because if you can get paired up with a really good instructor, then it could definitely be an amazing thing. So no, that's awesome though, that you continued.
Yeah. I like what you're saying, but there's various layers here. I mean, you can be a very good instructor and yet not be very good with certain type of people, because there's different type of personalities. And, you know, and then I had my own dive centers, for instance, and I had an instructor. She was really good with people who were a little bit claustrophobic, and because she had it too. So she had to fight that and get over it. And now she was really good with people who had a bit of tendencies in that direction. And while another very good instructor didn't necessarily have that expertise, you know, to deal with it. But so that's one thing. But then there's also the idea of, I mean, doing the basics properly. I mean, that guy, I mean, we went down and then that guy started running. I mean, he was a mile ahead of me. I was trying to catch up with him. He never looked back at me. At one point, I was running out of air because obviously I was pumping to try to get to it. And obviously, you know, with hindsight, obviously, you know, my trim was probably not very good. So I was probably dragging too much and all kind of stuff. But the point is that guy was just swimming ahead. I mean, ahead of me, not looking at me. And at one point I was out of air. I had to surf. I surfaced on my own.
Oh, wow.
And then I swam back to the boat and the guy didn't even realize I was at the surface, you know? So there's pairing instructors with people, you know, that they match based on their fears or their expertise or the type of personality. But then there's also having some basic quality skills as a dive instructor. And some of them don't have it, right? it's unfortunate, but that's what it is. There's a pretty much anybody can become a dive instructor, even if you're not good at all.
And that's a bummer to hear too, just because, you know, I it sucks because like I think of like all the different scenarios, and you know, there's, you know, I don't want to like call people out here, but there's instructors that definitely probably shouldn't be teaching. And then there's like the other side of it where maybe they just need to stop teaching. Like they've been, maybe they're burnt out and they're just kind of over it, but for some reason they're still going through the motions, and you start to lack just integrity. You start to lack, you know, professionalism because you're just kind of on autopilot. And I've seen that as well, where it's like, maybe, you know, you should take a year off or just step back. Yeah. But then usually when people do that, they end up not going back into it. And then, and from burnout, you definitely see some good instructors go down south really quick. So that's kind of a bummer that sort of thing happens.
Yeah. And everything you say is right. But I would add that for some instructors, what they need is coaching. And I talk a lot about that when, you know, what I do in the dive industry. But to me, you know, you can become a dive instructor because, you know, you showed an instructor examiner that I can, you know, show the 5 points of how to remove and replace my mask. But it doesn't mean that I know how to educate people, right? So what you might just need is coaching. And when I became an instructor, and again, I, with hindsight, I realized maybe I didn't take my instructor course or the right course director. But, you know, I became an instructor and I started teaching, and I mean, it was fine, but I wasn't, there was a lot of stuff that wasn't running smooth until I went and I went to teach with a Pro Dive in Fort Lauderdale with Richard Hartley and Jim Brandt. And these two course directors were amazing. And I mean, I learned so much with them, right? About everything, you know, about how to do my own skills properly, and how to supervise students, how to position myself, how to talk to people before the dive, how to do a briefing properly, how to recognize when everything. I mean, these two course directors are my heroes. One is unfortunately passed. Jim, I don't think he teach anymore, but he's in Guam. But with Richard Hartley and Jim Brandt, I've learned a lot. And all I did is I went there to teach with them. And it's like, it's coaching. So that's when I believe I became a proper, if I can, you know, say it to myself, but I think I became a proper instructor then. Before that, I wasn't, because all I did was the PADI instructor course, went to the IE, got the certificate, but I really didn't know actually what to do and how to do it properly. So having coaching, which is similar to what I do as an engineer. When I graduated, I had my engineering diploma, but I wasn't allowed to work as an engineer. So I had to, actually, I could work as an engineer, but I had to be supervised by another one for 2 years. Right. So you get coaching that way. And I think that's what's missing is, you know, you have to remove and replace your mask and have to demonstrate it in 5 points. Great. But that's not what's going to make you a good instructor. And everything else is not in the instructor course. And you're not going to get it unless you get coaching from somebody who has that experience. But that's nowhere in the industry. So that's how you ended up with a lot of instructors that are no good, but it's not necessarily their fault. The system is wrong. They just, hey, you are a dive instructor, so okay, I'll go teach. But well, they're not really a dive instructor. We're lying to them, right? Paddy's lying to them, saying, hey, you're an instructor. No, you're not, right? You've received training. The certificate is that you've received training, and you manage to demonstrate to an instructor examiner that you can remove and replace your mask in 5 points. But that's it. Okay, you've done that. That's great. You have to do that. But that doesn't make you an instructor. There's other steps missing after that.
To be honest, too, and I don't necessarily, I guess it is a form of coaching, but I feel that a big problem or one thing that I do see quite a bit is the pace that someone will go from, you know, your open water, advanced rescue, and then they hit the dive master, and it's a very short time before they'll go on to an instructor. And I definitely, so even one thing that I did, because I saw the value in it, maybe just from the things that I had witnessed, that if someone were to take like a year or just a little bit of time and stay as a dive master, then you're going, you're assisting. And I'm not talking dive guides. I'm actually saying like dive master, where you're assisting courses, you're taking in the learning, like seeing like, okay, I can go and work with this instructor, like the shop. I became a dive master, and then I went and worked in a shop in Central Texas. And they had a good amount of instructors there. So it was kind of nice as a dive master, because I could go and help with different instructors, help with different classes, learn different learning techniques. And I definitely found the value in that, because it's like, okay, I like the way this person's doing this. I don't like the way that person's doing this. And I can add to essentially my toolkit for when I became an instructor. And so I definitely think that, I mean, obviously there's no way that it's going to happen, but I definitely feel that there'd be value, like, hey, you know, stop here and learn as a dive master before you move forward, just because you'll get coached, you'll pick up a lot of valuable information. But the problem that I found, and I don't know if this is just across the board, but you know, as the dive master, you're like, oh, okay, I'm making pennies on the dollar. Here's the instructor making, I mean, they're still not making a lot of money, but they're making more than the dive master. So it's like, oh, okay, I just need to rush past this and become the instructor.
Yeah. I mean, in any field of activity, experience is generally good. So yes, of course, the more experience you have as a diver before becoming a dive master, as a dive master before becoming an instructor, or as an instructor before becoming an instructor trainer, should be good. But it's not necessarily always that direct, because I mean, if you're gonna work as a dive master for 2 years in a dive center with three instructors who teach everything wrong, well, you should actually not take experience there. You'd be better off taking an instructor course and get out of there, because you're going to learn for 2 years, you're going to learn it the wrong way. And now it's going to be a lot more difficult to unteach it. And I've seen it when I teach instructor courses. I've had instructor candidates who were outstanding, although they had completed their dive master course a month before. Right? And others would arrive with, you know, 3 years as a dive master, but they learn everything wrong and they're outright dangerous, but they never realized they were. And now you have a lot of work to deprogram and reprogram properly. So yes, make more experience is good, but that it has to be good experience. Otherwise it's no good. And since there's no coaching, there's no coaching, you know, really process for coaching dive masters or instructors. We just give them a card and hey, here you are. Then, you know, what are you going to get? I know when I became a dive master, I was in a dive store that, you know, I wasn't doing a lot of things, a role model there. But because I was traveling a lot for the railroad, and I was going all over the place. And I went to dive in Texas, and I went on the oil rig off the coast of Texas. I loved it. And I went diving in the Rockies and in the West. I mean, I went diving everywhere. And everywhere I went, I would call them and say, I'm a dive master, and I just want to go diving with you. And I would join classes they had. So I saw those instructors teaching, you know, rescue class. I remember rescue class in Calgary. That was amazing. I learned so much there. And I said, wow, you know, I think that's a lot better than my rescue course. So because I went to a lot of places and I saw a lot of good stuff, I think I learned as a dive master. But if you're just going to be in one dive store with one instructor doing everything wrong, well, 3 years is not going to make you a better instructor. So, you know, it's not automatic.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a valid point. Well, let me just, I guess, bring it back just a little bit. So you took that first open water class, when you completed that course, got your first certification, or even during that course, did you know that you wanted to continue your education? Did you know at that point that you wanted to become a dive pro in a sense, or did it just kind of happen as you're going through courses?
It just happened as I went through courses. So I kept working for the railroad. I still had plenty of money and time. So, I kept taking courses. And I often took courses outside of my hometown because, again, I would go somewhere, take the rescue course. I would go somewhere else, take specialties. I went in Banff in the Canadian Rockies to do altitude diving and ice diving. That was beautiful at the foot of a glacier. Magnificent, right? So I had fun. And there's also that discussion in the industry about, we're peddling C cards, and I think we are. I mean, there's a lot of specialties that are really worth nothing. They're totally useless. But I had fun, though, chasing those specialties because I would make it a trip or a weekend here or a weekend there. And then it gave me a chance to dive with instructors. So maybe the specialty itself is useless, but hey, I had a few more dives with an instructor, right? So, I've learned a few things, even if it wasn't related to that specialty per se, right? So that's what I did. So I did all, and then of course, well, I might as well do the rescue diver course, and then, well, I might as well do the dive master, and do the instructor, and then, well, why not I become a course director? It really just, what do I do next? And I mean, when I became an instructor trainer, then I got into tech diving. And you mentioned before that burnout, and I think when I was close to it, like tired of showing people not to remove and replace your mask underwater for the a million time, it's tech diving that prevented me from being burned out, in the sense that not teaching tech diving, but taking tech diving courses for myself. So I was training recreational divers and instructors, but then I would go and take tech diving courses for myself. And that's that was an additional challenge and something I could just do and just, not think about supervising anybody because I'm being supervised, right? So that's why I kept going, even into tech diving. It's always, well, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? But it's not, I don't think it was because I wanted to go to the top of the famous pyramid. It's just that I wanted another challenge. I wanted, do something else. I have another reason to go diving with a different instructor somewhere else, right? So that's how I progressed, and then I became a course director, and I became instructor trainer for tech diving too, but I didn't do a lot of tech diving, a lot of it. And then I ended up with my dive centers, but that was a bit of a mistake.
I do understand that notion. So I would maybe get like a little burnt out at the end of a summer, but then, traditional kind of four seasons in Texas, we during wintertime classes would slow down, gives, most of the instructors a little bit of a break. There was still a little bit of work, but not as much. So I actually took a break. So when I moved to Malaysia, I came here for work, non-scuba related, and I took a step back. I had to take a step back from teaching, which I was really bummed out about, but I was like, okay, I'll finish out this contract. I'll get back into teaching. But in the meantime, I can take classes for myself. And that's kind of when I started slowly moving into the technical world. And it has been a lot of fun. And I want to say it's like reinvigorated my passion for teaching to the point where I'm hoping to get back into teaching this year, just because I do really enjoy it. That's why my first question is always, tell me about your first breath underwater, because seeing that, light bulb moment or that aha moment or whatever you want to call it, of when it clicks with somebody underneath the water and they're like, holy cow, this is the absolute most amazing thing in the world. I do miss that. So I'm hoping to get that back. But the dive center, so there's, I'm sure the joke all too well, if you want to make $1 million dive shop, or how do you make $1 million dive shop? You start with two, right? So was that the, what did you not like about the dive centers, or what did you like about it? Or just tell me about the dive centers you've owned.
Yeah, I cannot say that joke applied, because I mean, I got the dive center for, I mean, a few peanuts, and it grew. I mean, it grew fairly big, and I actually made good money with it. What I'm saying it's a mistake is that it took me away from teaching and diving, because, you know, when you're in the busy season where everybody wants to go diving, well, the store is open, you know, nonstop 7 days a week, and you have everything, you know, rental and airfields and selling gear and selling courses and organizing instructors. And so it took me away from what I really like, diving and teaching. So that's why I'm saying it's a mistake. And also because, you know, I made money with that dive center. It grew, but that's because I have a background in I'm an engineer, but after that I did an MBA and I work in sales and marketing a lot. And so I applied very basic sales and marketing principles, so it grew, right? Because I think a lot of dive stores owners, I mean, they have good intention, but they have no notion of how to run a business. So that's why they have issues trying to grow their business. So it went fine. But I still would have made a lot more money if I had stayed in the railroad industry, right? I mean, so I had fun. Great. But, you know, if I had stayed in the railroad industry and not by the dive store, I would have made a lot more money, and I could have kept teaching scuba diving every weekend. And right. So with hindsight, I would not have bought it, but you know, I did. I still had fun. Fine. But no, I would not.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that a pretty tough decision for you, or did it seem natural at the time to move away from the railroad into, or did it just kind of come across the board like, hey, this dive center is for sale, why not just jump into it?
Yeah, well, it's the dive centers where I had done my open water pool sessions before going to Key West to get certified. And it was owned by an old guy, and he wanted to retire, and he had been trying to sell the dive stores for years. There was nobody to buy it, and he offered it to me, but you know, I looked at the numbers and it was like, forget it. I mean, it was a tiny little thing, you know. Annual sales were less than my salary at CN. And he had, you know, three staff to pay with that and the rent. And they're like, what, you know, it's doesn't make sense. But eventually, I remember I was in an airport somewhere flying back home. And he called me and he said, look, I'm going to give it to you for, it was something like 10,000 bucks or something. Ridiculous. I'm just out of here. I have to be out of it. I don't care. I don't care, you know, how much inventory or whatever. It's just 10,000. It's yours. I mean, so basically that's like buying compressors. So, well, I said I'll stop when I land. So I landed home and I went to see him straight from the airport, and he still had the same thing. Well, I'll just basically giving it to me. So I said, okay, fine, I'll take it. So that's how I did it. It wasn't anything. Then I called my accountant, and my accountant said I was losing my mind. But I said, well, who cares if I lose $10,000? Who cares? So I did. But then I started, like I said, applying some principles. And I mean, sales actually picked up pretty fast. And then it became fairly big, and we took the store next door and expanded. And then I said, well, you know, why don't I take a sabbatical from the railroad, just, you know, so I can see if I can, what I can do with that thing. So I did not decide to leave the railroad to go there, but I guess I did. I said, I'm going to take a sabbatical. Then I'm going to go work there for a year, see how it happens. But I never went back. Never went back to the railroad. You just, you're really a hamster in the wheel. It keeps running. And then first thing you know, it's been 10 years. Oh my God, I'm still here. So no, it was not a conscious decision.
No, that's awesome though. I mean that, you know, because there's definitely people have had that story go the other way where they jumped into it and then it just didn't go very well. And so you've obviously, coming into the industry, educated, seeing the good and the bad, is that what led to the Business of Diving Institute? Like, Tell me all about that.
Yeah, well, the Business of Diving Institute, I created that about 6 months after I bought that dive store. Because in my mind, I said, I bought the dive store, but I got to manage that part-time because I have a full-time job. So I wanted to give training to my staff on how to deal with customer, right? Everything, not just how to sell, but there are courses on how you deal with a unhappy customer, right? How you deal with complaints, all kind of training. Because at that point in the railroad, I was managing sales for a large division of that railroad. So that was, you know, $1.6 billion in sales with tons of sales managers, account managers. But we had training. I had very, you know, that I guess then it's kind of the engineering part of me, but I had the process, the way we select people and then the way we train them, continuously train them forever and ever. And so I figured, okay, what's the training? What's a training program for people to work in dive stores? You know, call Paddy. nothing. They had some, you know, visual merchandising CD. And I mean, nothing. There's nothing. Called around, tried to find something. There's nothing. There's nothing. So I said, well, we need training. There's no wonder that when you walk in a dive store and you don't feel welcome and everything, because none of these people have received training on how to deal with customers. So I created the Business of Diving for that purpose, set up training for dive professionals, but not necessarily instructors. It could be people working at dive stores. They might just have an open water certification card, but they work in a dive store. So that to me is also a dive professional to do that. But that's the reason I created it. But I have to admit, I never organized those training courses. So I just something I kept. And a few times it came close to it. Ivan had at one point a project to make it happen with Paddy, actually, with John Kinsella, was the head of DSAT at the time. That's the branch of Paddy that was doing the training material to create training programs for dive professionals, including people who work in the stores, right? But then it died. I mean, Paddy fired everybody, and John Kinsella ended up out the door. I mean, nowadays, Paddy doesn't have a lot of employees, right? I mean, they've just cut to the bone. And so that project went down the drain and it never happened. So there's a few times like that over the years that it almost took off, but never did, right? And now today, I'm mainly doing surveys, right? So what you might see on the Business of Diving website is mainly surveys the dive industry, because another problem in the dive industry is there's no data. No data. Because, you know, and I work in other industry. I also work in radio broadcasting and in the railroad. We have statistics coming out of our ears, right? I couldn't know how much tons move between two states and the cents per revenue ton miles for each commodity. And I mean, you have stats coming out of a year in a radio station. You know how much a radio station on average spends on talent and et cetera, et cetera. But so I wanted to know, well, what are the stats for the dive stores, right? So I can compare, you know, benchmark myself or have a goal. And again, well, no benchmark numbers, no stats, no numbers. Nobody knows what's the size of the dive industry. Nobody even knows that, right? So so that's why I started doing, you know, market surveys and studies and reports. And now that's most of what the Business of Diving Institute does is those surveys. Now, that's volunteer work. So, I mean, we do the surveys and then we publish the results. Doesn't give me any money. So it just... help people. So try to get more available market statistics for people who are in the dive industry.
So in your opinion, why is the data so hard to get?
First of all, you need somebody to collect the data, right? And disseminate it. In some cases, the governments collect a lot of data. So the U.S., whatever it's called, the Statistics Bureau, whatever, has a lot of data on railroads, right? And some cases is the government, but the dive industry is way too small for that. Then usually there are trade associations that also do that. One that does it really good is the SFIA in the U.S., the Sports and Fitness Industry Association. They do annual reports on a lot of stuff, and it's very good data, and it's statistically valid. And they even have statistics on participation in scuba diving and snorkeling and everything else, surfing and skiing and downhill skiing and kayaking, fishing, whatever. So the Sports and Fitness Industry Association does a lot of it. And then they sell those reports to their members. If you're a member, you buy it cheap. If you're not a member, it's expensive. So there's trade associations doing that. In our industry, well, the government doesn't do anything. We're just so small. I mean, it's ridiculous. And then, unfortunately, DEMA doesn't do what SFIA does, right? I mean, DEMA does the survey on certifications that's based on three certification agencies reporting. The other ones don't report. And that's it. I mean, so I don't know why, because there's some inertia at DEMA where you try to do something and the ball never starts rolling. It doesn't move. And I don't know why, because we get more data about the dive industry from the Sports and Fitness Industry Association than we get from the dive industry, our own dive equipment marketing association. It doesn't make sense that the Sports and Fitness Industry Association has more data on the dive industry than our own trade association has. I know when I was on the board, I was suggesting that why don't we join forces with the SFI, because they do those surveys already. So we could just, add a few questions that we want. And then that would be a lot less expensive than us trying to do it on our own. And there are people like the Outdoor Industry Association, that's exactly what they do. They piggyback on the surveys that the SFIA does. So why doesn't DEMA piggyback on the surveys? But again, it's like I was on the board. I was trying to get that ball to just forget it. It's like the force of inertia there is so big, the ball never starts rolling ever. So that's it. I mean, the government doesn't have it, and our trade association doesn't have it. The only data we have, basically, it's SFIA, right? And that's it. Now, the other reason is there's some paranoia a bit. I mean, the idea that you share market data, to me, is obvious. I mean, I was in a railroad, and we're competing against all the other railroads, but we still share data. I mean, it goes in a pot, and then everybody gets to see what's happening in the industry, right? It's good for everybody. But that concept seems foreign to a lot of executives in the dive industry. Immediately, if you start talking about sharing data, immediately they think you're a spy. You're trying to steal their business or something. I mean, every industry on the planet, you have industry data because everybody benefits from it. Everybody benefits from it. So you just do it. But in the dive industry, a lot of executives and many dive industry businesses, they don't seem to grasp that concept at all. I call it paranoia. I don't know what it is, but maybe just being uneducated. I don't know. But they don't understand the concept that sharing data together, putting it together, and it just doesn't happen. It scares them.
And are you saying that from an agency side or like a manufacturing equipment side or both? Yeah, both. Well, I guess they're probably all person moves from this industry or from this side of it to that side of it. It seems like usually people are kind of have their hands in multiple pots. So yeah, that's kind of a bummer to hear just because, I guess I never really looked at it in that side of it. I didn't know that it's hard to get that information just because I feel like on the business side of things, I don't know. I did not know that information.
Yeah, well, nobody knows. So I mean, like I said, when I bought my dive store, the first thing I wanted to know is, well, what are the benchmark? You know, what does a typical dive store look like? So I can see, how much I should spend on this and that, on average, what other people do. And then what is the size of the dive industry anyway, right? I mean, but no, forget it. Again, call everybody. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. It's mind-boggling because everybody knows the size of the broadcasting industry and the size of the railroad industry and the size of the trucking industry. Take any industry, people know the size, and they have statistics, and then they know. They can check their own company and say, hey, am I doing better or not? And if you're not a public company, so you don't publish your numbers to your shareholders, well, you publish to your shareholders, but, they're private, then, well, nobody's going to know your numbers because that goes in a pot, right? Somebody aggregate all that data, and then you get industry data. Now, within your company, you can look at it and compare, well, if the industry is going up 10%, I'm going down 5%, hey, what's happening? Let's try to understand it. But if I'm going down 5% and the industry went down 20%, well, actually, we were doing good. But nobody knows, right? Nobody knows right now. Is it up? Is it down? What's the size of it? Who knows?
Is that information in the other industries, is that a required thing, or is it voluntary? Is it like people volunteer that information?
Well, if it's a government thing, usually it's required, right? So, for instance, there's all kind of requirements on transportation companies. But then if it's a trade association, then it's not required unless in some association, if you're a member, you have to. As you become a member, you commit to doing certain things. But then there's a way around it. Like for SFIE, for instance, they go beyond that. They go beyond just what they do, studies on what their members report, right? Every year, members report, and it's aggregated, and you get business data that way. But then they also do surveys. So this is just random survey calling X number of people in the U.S. to figure out, for instance, how many people scuba dive, how many people ski, how many people go hunting, how many people go fishing, etc. So that's just a statistically valid call the population type of survey to get data. Now, they just, in that case, what they do is they pool money together and say, we're going to do this survey.
To move forward a little bit, besides the Business of Diving Institute, I'm assuming, are you still teaching? Are you still doing anything like that? Or have you taken a step back and it's just all fun diving for you these days?
Yeah, I haven't taught anything in quite some time. Yeah, I mean, I tried. I work for a company that manufacture surface supplied air systems. So instead of carrying your air in your cylinder, it's on the tube floating on the surface, right? And you have a hose, kind of a recreational version of what commercial divers do, right? And but the new systems are very small. It's smaller than a backpack, and it's electric, so you no longer have to worry about running that compressor at the surface that's running on gas, which could contaminate your air source. So it's running on batteries and it's very small and it's cool. So anyway, I did some work for that company, for instance, and we trained some people on how to go and coach people to use that kind of system. So, I mean, that I guess that's the last thing I've ever taught. But I haven't. That was a few months ago. I mean, I'm not very active on the teaching side anymore.
So just mostly fun dives for you these days?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not close to it. It's just, I mean, I don't have a dive store anymore. And I don't advertise or try to recruit customers. So, I mean, if somebody would call me and say they want to take a course, I would consider it, but nobody does. I mean, I don't advertise myself as available to doing it anyway, so. No, I haven't taught in quite some time.
Well, what was the last fun diving trip that you went on?
Oh, Mar. I think it was Bonaire.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I love Bonaire because you can do shore diving, right? And I don't know if you've ever been to Bonaire, but
I have not.
Most places in Bonaire, when you buy a package, it often comes with a pickup. So if you are in a condo type of things for four people, you usually will have a pickup with it for the four divers. I mean, there's all kind of different packages. You don't necessarily have to have a pickup, but a lot of them do, because then you just throw your stuff in the back of the pickup, and it's usually a small Toyota type pickup, and you just drive along the coast, and there's yellow stones along the road with the name of the dive sites. I mean, there's hundreds of dive sites. You stop anywhere because the reef is close to shore, and most places access by shore is visible. There's a beach, and some places they install stairs if there was no beach. So it's very well organized for shore diving. And that's why I just love Bonaire for that, because I don't know, maybe I'm an anarchist or something, but I get tired of the, you have to be here at 7:59 to get on the boat. And if you're here at 8:01, everybody's going to hate you for the rest of the day. I'm on vacation and I'm going to go diving when I feel like it. So that's the beauty of Bonaire. You just go whenever you feel like it. It might be at 6 a.m. or at 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. You just go whenever you want. And then you come back, you refill your cylinder, and you just go to the next whatever site you want to do. So I just love that place for that. All the shore diving. So they have boat diving, but I mean, you can do beautiful dive from shore. And the other thing is I personally love stopping and just watching, right? I just want to watch this. The first time I saw a frogfish was in Bonaire, and they're tough to see. But the reason I saw it is because I hovered right there in front of a coral head, and I didn't move for a long time. And then suddenly I said, oh my God, this is a frogfish right there. But if you just swim by, you wouldn't see it. You wouldn't see it. And on dive boat, usually you dive for, 45 minutes and you have to come back on board. Even though I have enough air for an hour and a half, everybody again wants you back on board because you have to get back on board right now. So, and then you just swim around. And to me, I don't see enough in those dives. But shore diving, I can go. And I mean, if I'm in 30 feet of water, I can be there forever with a cylinder. So I can just be there forever and just see what I want. And, and that's one reason why, for instance, I actually don't like Cozumel too much, because a lot of it is in Cozumel. You go by boat and it's drift diving and you just go too fast. And most people don't know when to stop in the current. I remember my last dive in Cozumel. We're just, flying by because there was fairly strong current, and I noticed seahorses. So I stop. I position myself in the current, stop right there, and watch those seahorses, right? But guess what happened, of course? The dive master was flying with the rest of the group, was just wanted to kill me, right? Because I stayed behind. Well, I want to see the seahorses. I don't want to swim. I can do that in the pool. I want to see the seahorses, but you don't. You just swim by. And in Cozumel, it's a lot of that because it's drift diving. But in most places, it's like that when you dive off a dive boat. Right? You just go in and they tell you you have to be back here. I mean, usually an hour is a long time. Often you get like 45 minutes. They want you back on board. You just go in and out. I don't like it. So I love Bonaire for that. Long story to say, I love shore diving out of Bonaire.
I completely agree. So there's a few places out here kind of along a very similar, like the one place in particular I'm thinking of is in Ahmed in Bali, Indonesia. And it's a lot of shore diving there. And the last time I was able to go out there, I just met up with a buddy and we just grabbed our tanks. And it's kind of nice because they'll drop the tanks off at the dive site and you just go at your own leisure. It's like you want to show up at 8, you want to show up at 9, 10, you know, whatever you want to show up, you go, you do your own thing, you come back. And I definitely miss shore diving. In Texas, it was all shore diving. Occasionally, I'd go out on a boat, but shore diving was free.
And you've done the oil rigs.
I have not actually, I'm quite sad to say that because I kept telling myself, I need to go out to the flower gardens. And it's even more sad to say is the only diving I've ever did in Texas was all freshwater. So never been to the Gulf. And I need to change that. I'm actually going to be heading back there a couple times this year, and get the flower gardens. Well, they do go to the oil rigs, but there's a few trips that go out there. Some, you know, different oil rig trips.
Well, the oil rigs, they're really something you want to do. I know, to me, I was impressed because usually you dive, you know, there's a reef or there's something or there's a wreck. And even if it's a wreck in the middle of nowhere, there's the top of the wreck that you see and then you go down. But when you get to these oil rigs, they're very high above your head. And then you jump in the water and it's just those pylons going down. And you don't see the bottom. You know, you're in, I don't know how many feet of water, but there's no bottom, right? So you just go down those pylons in the middle of nowhere. And you look, if you look around behind, there's nothing else, right? You're just there. And then the fish, they're all within that structure. And as you go down, their size increase. It's amazing to see. I mean, you see the small fish and then they get bigger and bigger. And as you go down, they get bigger. And I mean, it's like a postcard of this is the various levels of what's happening in the sea. It's just amazing, impressive. Now, you must not have vertigo because, you just, there's nothing else. There's no bottom neither. So, but if you don't have vertigo, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
No, I will have to, like I said, I'm really, really bummed out with myself, the amount of time that I spent in Texas that I never made it to the Gulf. And, because I have heard that it's a beautiful, beautiful area to dive in, but I don't know why it never happened, but it'll be something that I'll have to change for sure. Well, let me throw out my last couple of questions for you, and then I will let you go. If I am somebody that is looking into getting on the business side, maybe a dive shop, and you've, you know, explained some good things and bad things, but say I'm looking to open up a dive shop or a dive center, what are some points, what is some advice that you could give to that person? Don't do it, but don't do this. What's some of the best pieces of advice that you could give?
The first and most important thing you must do is buy my book on how to be a successful dive instructor. It's called Your Career and or Your Life as a Scuba Diving Instructor, because it's often there's a balance there. Like, a lot of people become dive instructor just for the lifestyle. So that lasts a couple of years and then they say, okay, I have enough. I need some money. So is it just a lifestyle or is it a career, right? How do you balance the two? But besides that, I say that you should focus on training. And let actually forget that. You should not focus on training. You should focus on scuba diving, the experience of scuba diving, which means if they're not scuba divers, you need to, you know, go diving with them. Right, which we typically do by selling them a course. But that's what you should focus on, not focus on the store. Because this old business model that all the local dive centers in North America, they're all dive shops, and they make their money selling gear. I mean, that's where I made my money, really. I mean, we were selling courses. I know if I had a bunch of students on a weekend, I would sell a lot of gear. And that's where the money was. But that's dead for a lot of reasons, right? First of all, everybody knows the price on the internet now, so you cannot jack up the price of dive equipment to subsidize your money-losing courses. That doesn't work anymore. And also because a lot of people now don't buy gear. The baby boomers used to be interested in becoming a diver, and for them it was something big. I am a diver. But the younger generations, from what we see in the stats, is that they just do scuba diving. So it's about doing it, not about being a diver. They do diving, among many other things. So if they go to Costa Rica, they might dive just for 1 or 2 days and then go hiking and then do all kind of other things. So they cannot buy all their scuba gear and everything else for every activities they want to do. So there's a lot more renting than buying gear. So you cannot open a dive centers now in North America and think I'm going to be a store. Forget that. You need to be a place where people can go and go diving with you. So you can organize trips with them. You can do all kinds of things, but your focus has to be on diving, not on selling equipment. So organize yourself to make money when people dive. Don't rely. I mean, sure, you can sell dive gear if you want, but I mean, basically count that as a bonus when you budget. Make sure you can make money just by helping people do what they want to do. And what people want to do is diving. Right? Nobody sits at home saying, hey, you know, I've always wondered when I would go buy a regulator. You know, no, people are sitting at home saying, hey, you know, I've always wanted to go try scuba diving. So that's what you have to focus on. Get people to go diving with you. And even the training, I would suggest you think more along the line of coaching than selling courses. Right? Because, I mean, that's another discussion we could talk about for 6 hours. But, you know, this concept of, you know, I'm selling a course, and then what happens is you want to do it as fast as possible and then get people out the door, and then they're not ready to go diving, and they did not have a good time. Like you mentioned before, you know, it's all skills. Well, you know, when they were sitting at home thinking, I want to go scuba diving, they were not seeing themselves removing, replacing their mask and their BC and this and that for hours, right? They were thinking about seeing turtles and seahorses, so, and Nemo. So they don't have a good time. But if you organize your business, your dive center, more along the line of I'm coaching people so they have a good time underwater, then the course, yeah, okay, you have to do it, but it becomes secondary. And then if it takes more time, if it takes, you know, 10 dives instead of 4, doesn't matter, because they're diving with you and they're having a good time, right? Why do you want to rush it? You're diving. So that's what I would say. Focus on figuring out your business model for your dive center. You're going to make money on giving legendary experience to people, the experience of diving, which involves coaching or training, if you want to call it. And then selling gear is just, there's just an add-on, but don't make your business about selling dive gear. That was the old business model. That's how I made money with my first dive center, but that doesn't work nowadays.
Okay. And then my last question, and I know you kind of answered it, but as someone that has produced a lot of instructors, someone that has seen a lot of instruction, good and bad, to the individual, what is a piece of advice that you could give to somebody that just completed their instructor training?
Coaching. Find somebody who's really good at it. Now, it's very tough to find, because when you go on websites, everybody says, hey, we're not like everybody else. Everybody, right? Every website says they're not like everybody else, which I find it sad, because in most dive centers and instructor website, there are statements like that, which is kind of saying that everybody has a bad opinion of the whole industry, because everybody feels the need to say that they're not like everybody else. You know, they're better. But regardless, everybody says that. So you have to find that person. And in my case, I was lucky, because I picked Pro Dive just because they were famous at the time. Now they're out of business, but they were the largest instructor training center around here, and they were in Fort Lauderdale, so it was a nice place. I said, yeah, I can go spend some time there. Sounds great. So, and I was lucky that it was Richard Hartley and Jim Brand that I ran into, and they were the best coach anybody could dream of. So if you're in Guam, go see a Jim Brand. Although last time I talked to him, he said he wasn't teaching anymore, but go see Jim. Insist that you want to hire him as a coach. But you have to find a coach, somebody you can teach with. And maybe that means you'll make less money, because if you're helping another instructor teach and the instructor wants to keep the money, then okay, maybe you're losing money there because you're just doing it. But you're going to learn so much if you do it with somebody who has experience, but good experience on how to train people properly. So you have to find that. But if you became an instructor, hopefully now through all those various courses, you've already have an idea of how to identify good instructors and bad ones. So find a good one and try to spend time with that instructor. And then take more courses. And again, I'm not saying that to try to peddle C-cards, because I do think we peddle too much C-cards and sell too many certifications that are useless. But still, look at it, because if you can take some additional courses with some instructors that you know they're good, well, that's going to give you a chance to practice things, because now you're the students again. So you can practice and have somebody who's good at it coaching you to become better, right? Yeah, because you have to become a better scuba diver and a better instructor, a better person at communicating and educating people. And then, of course, if you can, try to get at least some sort of knowledge of how to deal with customers. Because even if you're the best dive instructor in the world, you're going to have customers who are not happy, and they're going to come yelling at you. And there's very simple tricks of how to de-escalate the situation and turn an unhappy customers into a lifetime customer. There are very basic steps you can do, and there's a bunch of those courses online. I mean, take a bit of that, because it's your business. You're selling yourself. So try to get some training along those lines, and that's going to make a big difference on producing divers who want to come back with you and want to send you their friends. That's it. It's not easy. You have work to do.
Amazing advice, man. And I really, really appreciate it. And once again, man, I really, really want to thank you for coming onto the podcast today. This has been absolutely wonderful. And there's a lot more, like you said, we could have certain conversations for 6 hours. So I hope to have you back on, because there's definitely some more topics that I would like to pick your brain about, just because there's a wealth of information there. So no, once again, thank you very, very much for coming onto the show today.
My pleasure. And actually, I hope next time we meet is underwater. Maybe I'll go visit you.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast.